Hey there, beautiful souls. Welcome to Beyond the Surface, where the saying to be seen is to be understood comes to life. I want to begin by first honoring the traditional custodians of the land we live and work on. I live and work on Gundungurra land and acknowledge the traditional landowners of my guests near and far. I pay my respects to the elders past, present and emerging, for they hold the memories, the traditions and cultures of our First Nations peoples. The land below my feet is, was and always will be Aboriginal land. I am no stranger to the profound journey of pain, grief, anger and heartbreak that often accompanies the loss of church, community, faith and the unwinding of our core beliefs. In the midst of this labyrinth, I found healing in the stories shared by others who have walked a similar path. Each tale, unique in its own right, weaves an invisible thread of connection, uniting us through the tapestry of religious trauma and healing. Here, in the warmth of these digital walls, I want you to feel at home. This is a haven where your memories are not just acknowledged, but deeply seen and believed. So kick back, relax, and let's embark on a journey where your story is not just heard, but embraced. Welcome to a community where storytelling is a powerful force. This is Beyond the Surface.
Welcome back.
Thank you. Good to be back.
Yes. For those who are listening, this is your first episode. This is Matt's second episode for this podcast. It is part two of his story. And if you haven't listened to the first part, go back an episode and make sure that you listen to that for good context, not because we just want, you know, Matt to feel like lots of people are listening to him, just because it will be really, really helpful context.
That's right. It'll be very helpful.
But in, as a quick, short summary, Matt is an ex-Baptist minister who was essentially forced out of that position for his support for towards the queer community. And so we are now at the point of talking about, I guess, that process of deconstruction, which ironically I had never heard about until talking to you about it. And so it is now sort of at that point that we go, what, you know, you were not somebody who just like casually went to church every month or so, or like, you know, you were at the top of the food chain. You were front and center in a church leading other people as well as you. And so what is that process of deconstruction like for an ex-minister?
It's a bit of a journey, to be honest. And look, I know my journey, well, everyone's journey is unique, but my journey is a little bit different to other people in that there was a deep sense of spirituality before I became a minister. And if you have listened to that first episode, you know, it was very much nature-based and it was there since I was a child. My parents, call my parents a Christian family, but not a church family. So we weren't involved in church. They recognized the spirituality that was there within me as a child. Didn't really have the words for it, but sent me to church. And then church became the kind of the context to express that spirituality. And, you know, I really wanted to be part of that because I thought, well, this is my place, my tribe, and I could, you know, grow in that aspect of who I was. But because of that journey into church, there wasn't that sort of Christian heritage where you go to church as a kid and you're involved in all the church functions and all that sort of stuff. We never went to church on Christmas Day or anything like that. So church was kind of an add-on to the core sense of who I was and my spirituality. So when I became a minister, it was important to me, no question about it. And I took it very seriously. And I felt that it was, you know, using the language, it was my call. This is what I was supposed to do. And I thought I was going to be that until I died or retired, you know, whatever came first. And as you mentioned, it all came to a very abrupt halt. And after I left church-based ministry, I had numerous people asking me, you know, did this affect your faith? Did your understanding of God change? And most of the time, the people that asked that question were not Christian people. Were not that had been part of the church or anything like that. They were just interested because, one, they'd generally not ever met a minister before because they weren't part of that world.
Yeah.
And certainly had met a minister that had got forced out for supporting marriage equality. It was quite a unique situation, yeah. Story, and people were genuinely interested in what that meant. And it was hard to answer at the time because, in a sense, that spirituality that I'd carried since I was a child was still there and was still as strong as ever. But there was this disillusionment about this vehicle that I had chosen to express it, the church. It's like, I thought I was doing the right thing here. I thought I was being faithful to my calling. I thought I was doing exactly what my interpretation of the scriptures said to do, which was to care for the oppressed and the marginalized and welcome them into community. Even my sons at the time, now when it all happened, they were quite young. They were 6 and 8 years old. My 8-year old, one time I was sitting in the lounge room and he came and sat next to me on the couch and he said, "Dad, so what you were doing with people that were gay was you were just loving them, yeah?" So, yeah, that's what I was trying to do. And he said, "And that's what kind of Jesus tells us to do, yeah?" I said, "Yeah, that's right." And then he says, "And you got kicked out of the church for doing it." I said, "Well, yeah." And he just sort of shook his head and got up and walked away.
No.
I thought that kind of encapsulates exactly the whole thing. It's like it made no sense whatsoever.
Yeah.
So this disillusionment really set in. And so, you know, you talk about my deconstruction journey. There's an element that never deconstructed because it was there all the way through.
Mm.
But also there was another big part of it that was deconstructed or reconfigured, parts of it thrown out altogether. That meant that spirituality that I discovered that was seeded when I was a kid now was able to grow to a fuller extent because it wasn't bounded by walls of doctrine and theology and deacons meetings and elders meetings and this meeting and that meeting and
all of the business stuff,
endless committees and sharing meetings. It's like, what am I doing this for? You know, I never liked doing any of that stuff. For me, I used the language of calling before. My what I felt was my calling was to care for people.
Yeah,
simple as that. And in doing that, you know, being kind, showing love and compassion and welcoming people to the table. My calling was never about setting budgets and all that palaver, which, you know, I could do. I had to. It was part of my job.
Yeah.
I just didn't like it. And if I was totally honest, there was a part of me that just thought it was pointless.
Mm.
All we're doing is working out how to maintain a building at the end of the day, making sure we're raising enough revenue to pay the electricity bills and the gas bills for a building that was empty most of the time. So anyway, left the church, and it wasn't just leaving that particular church or that particular congregation. It was walking away from a job and a career, a community, lost probably 90% of what I thought were friendships at the time. I never heard another word from the denomination or the denominational leaders or anything like that. It was just like I just fell off the face of the planet, you know, and no longer existed. So it was a pretty dark time there. And I think I spoke about a bunch of that in the last episode. So what happened to me internally, both here and here in that time, you know, it's been an interesting process for me preparing for this episode, just to think through what actually did happen, what helped, what didn't help, because you don't know what's going on at the time. Some days I didn't even know which way was up. You know, it was just really confusing, traumatic time. I didn't use the language of trauma when it was happening, probably for the first couple of years, though other people used it. I didn't use it for myself because, well, you know, there was part of that sense of, well, of course you're going to face some opposition when you're faithful to your call and all that sort of thing, but you just never expect that opposition to be from within. You know, you kind of think that other people are going to make fun of you because you're a Christian.
Yeah.
never happened at all. It was all the hate mail and the death threats and everything that I got during that time all came from within the church, not just the church that I was part of, other Christian communities as well. So it was a really interesting space. The first few months, look, I can tell you what happened, but I don't remember it happening.
Yeah.
It was just running back and forth on the couch basically for about 4 months.
Yeah.
And, you know, I've got a list here of things that did help. Maybe I'll just run through them in no particular order because they didn't happen in any particular order. It was all one big jumble. I suppose the thing that I mentioned at the beginning, because it gets spoken about a lot, is the concept of time being the healer here. You know, over time, things will start to heal. I'm just going to call, I nearly swore on your...
Oh, no, you can call it bullshit because that's what it is.
Well, wasn't sure if I was allowed to then.
Yeah.
Let fly. Just going to call bullshit on that because while it does take time, if you're just sitting around waiting for time to heal you, nothing is going to happen. You're just going to be sitting around in the same puddle of mess, you know?
Yeah. I often say time heals nothing if you do nothing with the time.
Spot on. Absolutely. Yeah. Couldn't say that better. But the things that I needed to do took time to do. Mm. So there was nothing that's like, oh, do this and I'm instantaneously back on my feet and heading in the right direction. There are a couple of things. One conversation that comes to mind straight away was I was having lunch with a friend who is a lesbian woman, married, and I was morose. You know, I would have been horrible, horrible company that day. And she was just there to kind of care for me and check in and see how I was.
Mm.
And I was just talking about, you know, how I was feeling and what the people were saying about me and how this story had just sort of taken off and was in the media now and it was on TV and radio and a whole bunch of it just wasn't true. It didn't happen. You know, it was becoming this mythical event that I would read about or listen about and think, who's that?
Yeah.
Actually me they were talking about. And this woman that I was having lunch with, she, you know, heard my story and everything. And then she said this kindly. It might come out as sounding harsh, but she said this kindly and compassionately. She kind of looked me in the eye and she said to me, Matt, now you know how we feel. Talking about
exactly what I was thinking.
yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Talking about how the queer community had been treated all along. And yes, I was a supporter and an advocate and an ally and all that sort of thing, but I was a straight guy and I knew that I could change my mind any minute and become the poster child of, you know, the right-wing conservatives, all that sort of stuff.
Yeah.
I had choice, queer community didn't.
Mm.
And so in that space, I had a real taste of what it was like to be queer, not just looking from the outside in, but in a sense, a kind of part of it now.
Yeah.
And that in itself was kind of a bit of a turning point. It's like, oh, okay, so what's happening to me is not unique. I'm not being scapegoated. I'm not being treated any differently. I'm actually now experiencing what it's like for these people that I've been caring for the last 25 years.
Mm.
You know, a real firsthand experience of it. And so in that sense, I realized, well, I'm not alone here. You know, there are a lot of people on this journey and there perhaps would be people that would be quite good advocates and allies of myself that now that this has happened would actually come out of the woodwork because, you know, that title of Reverend is a barrier to a whole lot of people. People assume that I believed all sorts of things and would do all sorts of things. Now that that had been removed, it just opened up the possibilities for different connections.
Mm.
And there was another conversation that happened at the same time, around the same time, different person. And this person said to me, as I was talking about, you know, well, I thought this is what I was supposed to do for the rest of my life. They looked at me and they said, well, you are.
Yeah.
But there is no way I'm setting foot back in a church if this is how when, you know, you have an idea that's different to theirs or they don't like, you know, you're getting death threats on the phone and in the mail and stuff. I don't think I want to do that anymore.
Yeah.
And they said to me, no, that's not what I'm talking about. They said to me, your calling has remained unchanged through all of this. Your job is changing, but your calling is still the same. The calling that you have to care for people with love and compassion is still there. You just need to find a different way to do it.
Mm.
Oh, okay. So that was a bit of a turning point as well, recognizing that I wasn't alone in all of this and that my journey was still heading in the same direction, even though it was going to look a bit different to what I thought it was. Yeah. They were pretty significant realizations for me. Still a really dark time. I was seeing a psychologist at the time and suspected PTSD through everything that was happening. So that seeing the therapist was really, really good. And that was another turning point in that I don't really think he had any clue about religious trauma or anything like that. You know, he was just there. He was an older gentleman and, you know, we talked about all sorts of different things. And I think he also was a bit intrigued by my story. So a lot of the questions he asked had nothing to do with my healing and my journey. It was just about his interest. And
yeah.
I haven't heard about that before. Anyway, one of the things that he said to me was, well, Matt, you seem to be, you know, good with people and you're warm, you've got a warmth and all that sort of stuff. And he just said, almost casually in passing, why don't you do what I do?
Yeah.
So, what do you mean? So, well, why don't you do what I do? Why don't you become a therapist?
Mm.
It never even crossed my mind.
Yeah.
So I thought, oh, well, okay, maybe that's a possibility. So I went home and I looked at psychology courses. And it was going to take me another 6 or 7 years to become a full-fledged psychologist. I had 4 degrees by this point in time. The idea of doing another 7 years to get another one, it's like, nah,
no, yeah.
Can't do that.
Yeah.
And then another conversation within the same week, a person said to me, you know, have you ever considered becoming a counsellor?
Mm.
And that was a really beautiful follow-on from the prompting from my therapist. And so, oh, okay, I didn't realize that that was a different thing. So started looking at counseling courses and realized I could do my master's in counseling relatively quickly within 2 years and start a new journey. So that's what I did, not really knowing where it would go, but I had to do something because of the way the church stuff had ended. There was some legal stuff that was there. And because what happened was illegal in terms of workplace law and all that sort of thing, there was a payout there that meant I could take 6 months and study.
Mm.
So I did. I started a master's in counselling. And you know, I think I mentioned in passing some of the difficulties that were happening at home.
Mm.
I sat in the food court at the local shopping centre and I studied all day, every day, my master's. Yeah. And that's what I did. And I think that was an important part of the healing journey as well, and also the deconstruction, the idea that there was something that I could learn, something that I was curious about, something that I could ask questions that would point me towards the future rather than keep me looking towards the back of what had happened. And I actually really, really enjoyed that study. Some of the reading was hard going, far out, and there was lots of it.
Yeah. And so were you at this point simultaneously, I guess, learning about how you could help other people but also learning about what is going on for you internally?
Yes and no. So the stuff that I was learning about becoming a counsellor absolutely equipped me to help people in a different way than I had as a minister.
Mm-hmm.
Some of that applied to me. You know, you can't help but learn those sort of things and realise, oh, yeah, maybe I'm a bit more messed up than I thought I was.
I think everybody who has become a therapist has that moment. Like, am I really equipped to do this?
Yeah. But I think the biggest benefit in the deconstruction side of things was it opened up my understanding of what is helpful, what is not, other paths that people take, and the role that spirituality can play in all of that. You know, the idea of holistic care, caring for the person's mind, body, and soul. That meant one thing in the Christian church, but it meant a different thing in the wider context of people helping. So, you know, that was a really good journey. I read a lot, learned a lot, enjoyed all the assessments, and even simply going to, this is before COVID, so it was all face-to-face learning classes. Even going into a new setting and rubbing shoulders with new people that had no idea about my background or anything like that.
Yeah.
It was quite refreshing. I wasn't Pastor Matt to any of these people. I was just fellow student Matt. And there was something very refreshing about that because there was no expectations about what I believed or what I should say or what I should do or what I shouldn't do. And I tried to not tell anybody that I was a minister or anything like that. I would talk about being in, I've been in community health for the last 14 years.
Yeah.
That's how I described it.
Yeah.
Because, you know, there's still a whole lot of assumptions about the church stuff.
Yeah. And so how did the view of other people, the way that they saw you, which was just as normal, regular, well, not, maybe no, maybe not normal.
That's recorded. You called me normal.
I was like, we might retract that. But just regular old Matt, how did their view of you impact your view of you?
That's a really good question. How did their view of me impact my view of me? I think some of it was a bit of an ego check, to be honest.
Yeah.
You can't help when you're a senior pastor have a big ego. You're up the front.
Doesn't it come with the job title? Like, isn't it in the job list?
A little bit. Now, that doesn't mean people are arrogant or anything like that. Still can be quite humble.
Yeah.
But there's an ego there because I'm up the front. I'm speaking to 300 people every day and they're taking my teaching and trying to apply it to their life and will look towards that person for discernment and almost as a mouthpiece for God and all that sort of thing. Of course, you can't help but have some sort of ego there or form some sort of self-worth through that. You know, part of your identity is in that space. Nobody treated me like that at all outside of the church. And it was a recognition that, okay, being a pastor, it was just a job. You know, I thought I was this, you know, sort of centerpiece of church life for a lot of people. The moment I step out of that role, someone else steps into it and they take over the same thing. It's not actually to do with me at all. It's the position.
Yeah.
And so, you know, it was a humbling experience and it helped me recognize a bit more about the reality of where my strengths lay, where my weaknesses were, where the brokenness was. And that, not that I ever thought I had all the answers, but I realized I had even less than I thought I did.
Yeah.
And that some of the things that I was hearing from these other people were actually better answers to things that I'd wrestled with. And some of those answers were things that I knew my church communities and even the theology that I taught would look down upon or would talk about as evil or as wrong or, you know, just not something that a Christian person should even entertain being connected with. Yet I could see it bringing healing and wholeness to the lives of other people. And in my mind, if anything brings healing, restoration, wholeness, fulfillment, purpose, all of those sorts of things, there must be an element of spirit to that. Because in my mind, spirit, I'll just use the language of spirit rather than the language of religion for a moment. Spirit being that thing that brings us together, that brings wholeness and healing. Wherever there's an element of that, there must be an element of spirit. And if there is such a thing as evil, evil is the thing that pulls those things apart. And as I reflected on that, it's like, well, at this point in my journey, the things that are bringing people together and forming community and bringing healing, they're the things that my old community would have said were evil.
Yeah.
The things that were pulling people apart and causing internal turmoil and all of that sort of thing, that was being done by a community that was supposed to be godly.
Yeah.
I was doing the thing that was evil. And so that was one of the things that I wrestled with the most in terms of the deconstruction journey, was that I was part of this community, this movement that was actually causing far more harm than I thought it was. I don't want to deny that there's a lot of good being done.
Yeah.
Of course. But there's more harm being done than I realized. And often that harm was being done quite overtly, you know, words that were happening from the front or within the community, attitudes that were there, but the results of it or the impact of it was silent or hidden. You know, people that were being hurt and traumatized by Christian community would just drift into the background and they'd be on the role as a non-attender now. Yeah. And that was, you know, not recognizing that they're a non-attender because they can't step inside the building because of the trauma it was causing them at that internal level. And I really carried that heavily, and that I missed that. You know, that was happening in every church that I served in. That was happening, and I missed it. I saw some of it sometimes, but most of it I missed and didn't see. And I think back over the years and the different people that were part of my churches, and it does. It breaks my heart to know that they actually were harmed by being part of my communities rather than healed.
Yeah. I think one of the most painful parts of deconstruction is actually realizing the role that you had in upholding a really harmful system for a lot of people.
Yeah. So one of the things that I have done as a counselor since then, when it's appropriate, I don't do it with everyone, of course, is when I have a client who is from the queer community and has a faith background and is trying to reconcile their own sexuality with their spirituality, going out on a coming, they're on a coming out journey. One of the things that I'll do sometimes as part of their healing journey is I will apologize to them for the hurt that the church has caused them. And if it's appropriate, if faith is still important to them, I will say to them, and God loves you for who you are. You don't need to change that part. Without fail, there is tears that happens in the counseling room when that is said. And sometimes the response is, you're the first person that's ever said that to me, that's ever apologized and has ever said that I'm okay. And there's a huge part of me that just wants to somehow find the names and addresses and phone numbers of everyone that was part of my churches ever and say the same thing to every single one of them.
Yeah.
Now, there has been a few opportunities for me to do that, that, you know, people have come out and they've been part of conferences that I've spoken at or whatever, and they've come up to me and, you know, been able to apologize. Also champion some of them that have become quite strong advocates and voices in the queer community and facilitating amazing change around the place. It's like these people are incredible, and it's quite a privilege that I've even just played a little part in their journey.
Yeah.
But I think, gosh, what did I put them through for them to have to get to this point? You know,
yeah. It's like
we could have got there perhaps a whole lot easier. So that to that day, that part of the whole deconstruction journey is the hardest, knowing that I was part of a system that caused so much harm and still causes so much harm.
Yeah. Now, anyone who knows you knows, I know what part of the answer is going to be for this, because anybody who knows Matt knows that he likes nature more than he likes humans.
Not all humans.
But I mean, you've alluded to it multiple times in this episode and in the previous episode about your connection to nature. And I would imagine that that would have again played a huge role in the way that you started to, I guess, what we would call heal or come back into, you know, a more authentic sense of self.
Yes.
Short answer. Of course, duh. Yeah.
Yes, absolutely. So, you know, I'm finding myself without a job, without a community, missing a whole bunch of people that I thought were friends, home life not great, and so that also being a source of trauma. There's only so much time that I could spend in the shopping centre food court, being, you know, the introverted, highly sensitive person. It would become overstimulating sometimes. So most days I would just walk and walk and walk along the river or in the mountains, in the reserves and wetlands near where I live. And, of course, the exercise was good. How, you know, just the rhythm of the walking is good for helping to process things. But there was also a healing that was happening that, you know, at the end of those times that I spent in nature, it just felt like things were going to be okay. You know, I can't really describe it any other way. This will be okay. You know, the trees that I was walking amongst was the same trees that I'd walked amongst 10 years before when I was a reverend. You know, they were still there and they still gave me oxygen and they still provided shade. They had grown and they had changed a bit. But it became a place of comfort. And in forest therapy, you know, refer to the other podcast, in forest therapy, we talk about the more than human community. And I felt like this became my community. This became my place of healing, of wholeness. There were many nights where my boys and I would just lie on the grass and look at the stars, you know, on those warm summer nights. And we would laugh and we would cry and we would make plans for the future. Sometimes we would just lie there in silence. Sometimes we would hold each other. Mm. You know, there was just some incredibly beautiful moments that happened out there. But also ideas started to flow, things that I could do, things that had been in front of me the whole time in terms of spirituality, in terms of connection, that now are starting to interpret differently or recognize differently or learn differently. And recognizing too that a lot of our lifestyle had removed us from nature and we'd become very building and concrete and city centered. And perhaps that had been the source of some of that internal sickness, for want of a better term, that was happening regardless of what had happened at church. So the reconnection with nature was a really beautiful thing. And it became a place where I could do some of the deep thinking and the deep contemplation and the asking of what if type questions, or what if I did this? What if the counseling thing worked out okay? And what if I started my own business? Or what if I worked for somebody else? Or what if this, what if that? And it was almost like the trees were not just holding me, but almost championing me and saying, come on, you know, you can do this.
Mm-hmm.
It's good to have you lying here, but you got to get up and do some stuff eventually.
Yeah.
And so it was a really lovely experience. It was almost like the stillness that I could experience there was sacred ground. And as I rethought my history, even some of the Bible stories and things like that, started to recognize that all the way through, nature was a very prominent player.
Mm.
And just the thing that came to mind then was, you know, Moses encountering the bush, burning bush. And there's another nature motif there. And so it became this incredible place that not just became this thing that decorated the landscape, but actually became life-giving and something that I wasn't over, but something that I was part of. So since that point, I've tried to spend as much time in nature as I possibly can, you know, the house and everything decorated as such. And with my counselling work and forest therapy work, I take people outside quite a lot, particularly those that are on the deconstruction journey, because one of the things that happens is our mind becomes really full with the questions. Well, what if this? But if this is the case, then what does that mean for what I used to believe? And there's a grief associated with that. Go out in nature and you can just experience a stillness that clears the mind and brings a little bit of clarity, perhaps create some space where you can just wrestle with one thing at a time or nothing, just give your mind a bit of a break. But also recognizing that there is life everywhere, you know, whether it's in the butterfly that's landing on the flower, whether it's in the tree itself, in the bird that's eating the seeds, there is life surrounding us everywhere. And when it comes to spirit, spirit gives life. So there is spirit everywhere here. Richard Rohr talks about nature as being God's first Bible. And that was kind of what I was experiencing. I was still experiencing spirit in this very pure form without any curtains or walls of doctrine or theology. It was just me and spirit there. And there was something really, really life-giving about that. The challenge was, well, how do you put that into words? And it's like, still struggle to do that to some extent. So sometimes the best thing I can do is take somebody else out into nature with me so they can experience it. You know, I do that most days now.
Yeah.
So just reminds me, don't forget you're coming down to do
it. Matt's been trying to get me to do a forest therapy session for like 3 years now, maybe even longer.
You should record it.
It is possibly on the cards for next year, but I will think about it.
That became the place of healing for me. And
yeah,
over time, I took more and more people outside, and sometimes I'd use the language of, well, this is, you know, my cathedral, the cathedral of trees, these soaring mountain ash in the Dandenongs and things like that. There was something incredibly sacred and majestic about it at the same time.
Yeah.
And I'd have these moments that I'd never encountered in church, because in church I was making sure that the welcomers were doing their thing and someone was going to collect the offering and I've got my notes for my sermon and where's the musicians and all that sort of stuff. Church was just hard work.
Mm.
Whereas out here, often I'm still working, but it's different.
Yeah.
And I had this really lovely experience earlier this year where a young guy, I don't know, in his late 20s, I suppose, maybe early 30s even, came along to one of my forest therapy experiences, a three-hour one. And he had been part of my youth group many years before. And he came along just for his own well-being, just as a self-care exercise. And we did the event, went for 3 hours. And then at the end of it, we have like a little tea ceremony type thing where we just gather around the picnic rug and have some tea and some snacks and just share a little bit about what our experiences have been like. And so we did that and he lingered afterwards. And he came up to me and said, Matt, I don't know if you realize this, as what you do here, it's just like what you used to do in church. No, don't ruin it for
me. I'm sure that was not the compliment he intended it to be.
Well, it was quite thought-provoking in that when I thought about it, you know, I would gather people together at the beginning. We would do some things to slow ourselves down and connect ourselves to nature. There'd be a series of exercises that we would walk to in different places in nature, very similar to like a Stations of the Cross service. Mm-hmm. And then you'd gather around the picnic rug or the table at the end and share some drink and some food, mm-hmm. similar to communion.
Yeah.
And I thought, that's really, really interesting in that I feel far more comfortable doing this than I ever did doing the church stuff. And perhaps this is where the whole journey has been leading to that whole time, from when I was a child, you know, exploring the rivers and the mountains and the trees, encountering wildlife and things like that, just by myself as a kid. This is what it was leading me to yeah. expression of spirituality that happened in nature, that was still a gathering of people, that still was working towards healing and wholeness and kindness. Perhaps this is actually where I'm supposed to be. And all of that sort of stuff, as painful as it was really important in terms of my own formation and contributed to me getting to where I was at that point in time.
Yeah.
So that was actually, well, it was a little bit confronting to hear. Still quite a lovely moment, or a lovely moment of realization that
yeah.
Actually, this is all okay. It's still part of it.
Is there something that people might find surprising about that you used or that you did that was part of your healing journey?
A couple of things. There was, for a long time, my dad was very artistic, or is very artistic, and one of the things that we used to do as a family, or my sister and myself and my dad, is we would sit around the table and we'd draw together.
Mm-hmm.
And often dad was a gardener as well. And so sometimes he'd put one of his pot plants in the middle of the table that was in bloom and we'd sit around, we'd draw it together. Now, his was always brilliant. My sister's was usually brilliant as well. And mine just looked like a cartoon, you know, so I just didn't have the patience to yeah. do the fine, intricate details that my sister and my dad could do. It still looked good. It just looked very different. Mm. And so right through my life, cartooning and illustrations and things was just kind of like a hobby that I did just on my own. I never really showed anyone anything. And then after I finished at the church and I'd started my counseling journey, I had a friend of mine were talking about, well, you know, how do I earn some income here, because you know, I've got bills to pay and all that sort of thing. And they challenged me about trying to, you know, do a little bit more with my drawing. And one of the things they said was, you're a good public speaker, you're good with kids, you've got a creativity about you. Why don't you try and form some sort of well-being program that uses cartooning as the tool to teach that? And I'd never really thought about that before. It seems to be a common theme that, you know, everybody else sees these things and I don't.
Yeah.
So I gave it a go, and within probably 2 years, I was seeing 10,000 students a year.
Wow.
So that creative element was actually quite important to be drawing different characters and telling different stories. I wrote and illustrated 4 books during that time that came out of my work with the schools. And there were lots of moments where I just sit down and I just draw and draw and draw and draw all sorts of different characters and animals and things like that, illustrate other people's books, or, you know, might get a few commissions here or there. And so that was a really good healing moment for that mindful aspect that it's, you know, it's good for you and good for yourself and your well-being, but also in terms of redefining a little bit who I was. So for some people, I wasn't Matt the pastor or even Matt the counselor. I was Matt the cartoonist. So just having a different identity was quite good. So I think creative stuff is quite vital, whether it's drawing or painting or gardening or knitting or doing sculpture or learning an instrument or whatever. It doesn't matter. As long as there's a creative element to it, it doesn't matter if you suck at it. Just it's the process, you know.
So how good at knitting are you, Matt?
I'm not very good at knitting. I did learn to knit at one point, but I'm not very good.
No, my grandmother knits like every day for as long as I can remember. She knits every single day, and she's tried on multiple occasions to teach me how to knit, because basically the generation of knitting will end with her because nobody else can do it. I tell you what, it takes a lot of technique. Like, you have to do like multiple things with 2 hands and they're doing different things and you have to counting stitches, and it is like, it's very detailed. So but yeah, I can't see you knitting a whole lot.
No, I think like I couldn't do those detailed drawings that my dad did. I wouldn't be able to do
anything. Yeah.
Fine detail, that's as opposed to the cartooning stuff with some black lines and some color. That happens quickly, you know. I like that.
Yeah.
So that was perhaps an unexpected source of healing, even though it had always been there. I'd been doing drawing in one way, shape, or form since, you know, my teenage years.
Yeah.
It really took off during that time. Now, just for completeness, COVID killed that off entirely.
Yeah, I bet. I was like, that would not have survived COVID.
No, it did not. So 2019, I saw 10,000 students or just over.
Yeah.
2020, I didn't see a single one.
No, yeah.
And look, I know I could always sort of take it up again and give it a bit of momentum, but I think that chapter itself has closed, which is a reflection of my journey, and I've been putting more effort into still with some schools work, but now the nature-based stuff.
So yeah.
Not being but using nature as the tool rather than cartooning.
Now, I ended the last episode with what you wanted to say to people who are going through deconstruction. I'm going to take a little slight turn here and put you on the spot, because I've not given you any warning about this question. What do you want to say to the church or to the pastors out there?
Sometimes I don't want to say anything.
Yeah.
I don't want anything to do with it. It's like, you go and do your thing and I'll do my thing and let's just leave it at that.
Yeah.
Other times I feel an incredible compassion for people in pastoral ministry who, you know, they're doing their thing and they're doing it faithfully, but they're not allowed to ask questions and they're not allowed to be curious. It's almost like their own growth has to stop because they're expected to do a certain thing. And, you know, the burnout rate is still astronomical in pastoral ministry. And I see a lot of those people in the counselling space. And when we raise the possibility of, is this something that you think you want to do for the rest of your life? Often the answer is, no, I don't, but I can't do anything else.
Yeah.
And I guess for those people, what I would want to say is that we see you. People see you and recognize that pain, and that while you might feel like there's nothing else you can do, you actually have a lot of transferable skills. You do not have to be a counsellor, not by any stretch of the imagination, but there are other things that you can do. Please don't feel that, like I discovered, that your calling and your job are the same thing. They're actually different things, and you can continue your calling beyond the church if you want to. So I would say that to some people. And then there are others that, you know, they're loving what they do and they're loving the message and almost oblivious to the pain that some people are experiencing through that. There's numerous things I'd like to say to them. I won't say. But I would encourage them to recognize the pain that those words cause. And if you are certain that you are speaking the truth and that you're going to continue to speak those words, still be compassionate to those that are hurt by them. And even say to them, maybe this is not the church for you. Sometimes the most pastoral thing you can do is send them to another church that might be more affirming, for instance. You know, recognize the pain that's there, own it. And, you know, if you are listening to this and you think, well, none of my words cause pain, I thought the same thing too.
They do.
And there is a history, hundreds, perhaps thousands of years of damaged people, some that even died at their own hands because of it, that would suggest that the words and the theologies and the doctrines really, really hurt. So my words to that group would be to just be aware, just know that that's inherent in the belief system, in that worldview. And just because it hasn't impacted you that way doesn't mean that it doesn't impact others.
Yeah. Where do you see the church going in the next decade?
The warning for these questions would have been nice.
But then we just get the raw responses, and what's better than that?
Yeah, I don't think the church will disappear. I don't think that will. Because, like I said earlier, the church does really good work in some places. It does clothe the naked and shelter the homeless and feed the hungry. It does that, and it does it brilliantly, and I don't want to see that stop, because it would be disastrous if that was removed from our community. So it's really hard to know, to be honest.
Yeah.
I think in some instances there'll be a, you know, almost a retreat into Christian bubbles where there'll be these pockets of conservative belief and there'll be attacks happening, you know, outward attacks saying, well, those people are wrong, those people are wrong, and we've got the truth, and if you want to come with us.
Yeah.
So there'll be these pockets of conservatism that will hunker down, and that they'll be all over the place. Necessarily connected or coordinated or anything like that, but just different groups of people that find comfort in the conservatism. They will always be there. There'll be other churches that take a deep breath and step into a more progressive theology. They'll lose 2/3 of their congregation overnight. But then in the next 2 or 3 years, they'll grow to be bigger than they've ever been. I can see that happening. It just takes a few brave people to actually lead that. My frustrations are there's some incredibly gifted leaders that say nothing about being affirming, for instance, until they retire when they have no influence. It's like, why didn't you say this when you were still the senior pastor of that place? You could have
facilitated
that change. But one of the people said to me, I didn't do that because of what happened to you.
Yeah, exactly. I was like, if your story taught them anything, it's to shut that's up.
I've got to own that. There will be more that do that, though.
Yeah.
Younger generations come through and step into those spaces. But I think there will also be a whole bunch of churches that close down, that vanish, that just disappear. And some of that will be because of, you know, the recent Royal Commission into sexual abuses in the church, and there's huge payouts that are happening even as we speak. To fund those, denominations are selling off buildings left, right, and center. And so congregations have to close because they're not viable, and the denominations need that money to pay insurances and all that sort of stuff. Others will just close because there's not the interest there anymore. So I think in a sense there'll be a shrinking of the church, but also growth in those two different areas, the progressive affirming, yeah, conservative non-affirming space. And I don't think that the, for want of a better term, the conflict between those two groups is going to disappear. It's going to stay there. There's going to be rocks thrown back and forwards. And just like has always happened, you know, we've got progressive group, conservative group throwing rocks and spears at each other, and right in the middle here are the people getting hurt.
Yeah.
In a sense, walking away from the church or being forced out of the church freed me from either of those things to then place myself in the middle there where I hope I can fulfill my calling.
Mm. Thank you.
Pleasure.
Thanks for answering curveball questions.
I wouldn't expect anything else.
I will pop some details in the show notes about how people can get in touch with you. But yeah, thank you for coming back again. Third time's the charm. We'll get it right eventually. Yeah, thank you for coming back and I guess giving people some practical ways of things that they can do to in their own journey, you know, nature, therapy, creative outlets, all of those things that people tend to just either forget about or dismiss really quickly. So I think that will be wonderful for people.
Thanks, Sam. Good to be here.
Thanks for listening to Beyond the Surface. Until next time, take care, stay true to who you are, and remember, your voice and your story matters always.